Hey, let's get started. Hi, everybody. Okay, hello, everyone. See, we are fewer people, but maybe people will be joining as we go along. Okay, I'm gonna get started sharing my text. This class, as always, is for the Refuah Shlema of all of the psu'im and for the success of our soldiers and for the continued and safe return of all of our hostages. And also, in particular, I want to ask for a schut for Refuah Shlema for Talia Bat Miriam. Okay, let's get started. So we did animals last week. We're going to continue. We have a couple animals that we didn't get to last week that we're going to finish up with. But beyond that, today we're going to be talking more about the natural world, Chazal, and the world around them, right? Whether that's plants, or its kinds of natural structures. We're going to get to caves and different things like that. Hopefully, we might get to them next week. And these have ramifications for Chazal for many things, right? Among them, halacha, of course. But just like we saw that animals can be teachers for Chazal, plants can be teachers for Chazal also, that other things in the natural world, it's all things that we can learn from. We're also going to hear a little about medicine, about food, different sorts of things. The picture that you're looking at is a picture from the beautiful park of Neot Kedumim. Okay, we've mentioned this a few times in various classes. Neot Kedumim is a reserve for plants and animals of Tanakh and of the Mishnah. So you could learn all about how wine was made and how it was made in Bitara, and you have mikvaot and you have all the different stages of making bread, etc., etc. We're not going to go into that stuff so much today, but still, it's a nice picture to have. Okay, to return to what we didn't get to last week. Okay, we were talking about animals. One of the animals that is less obvious to talk about, right? It's not like a donkey or a horse, but it's still important, are elephants. Okay, elephants are very exotic. Obviously, they are not native to the land of Israel. However, already early on, right, in the time of the Canaanites, even before Bnei Israel come into the land, we have ivory, right? We find ivory here from the very wealthy cities like Megiddo, and that's what you're seeing in this ivory over here. It was something that was a luxury item that people wanted because it was a status symbol. It's a luxury item because you have to bring it from afar. It's also something that you have to make, right? You have to have craftspeople who can make these beautiful, beautiful things. So we have it in Canaanite times, and we have it in the times of Am Yisrael. Okay? One of the things that the prophet Amos is very much a prophet of social justice, right? And he indicts the rich for not taking care of the poor. And he's talking about the wealthy people in Shomron who lie on their ivory beds, right? Their mitot shen. Now, it doesn't mean the whole bed is made out of ivory. Elephants' tusks are not that big. Okay? What it means is you have some that kind of like a headboard or a footboard that has these beautiful inlaid ivory pieces. Okay? We found these. He's talking about the people in Shomron when they did excavations in Israelite Shomron. They found ivory pieces. Okay, I almost knew what he was talking about. More recently, in excavations in the city of David, in a beautiful, huge house from late First Temple times, they also found hundreds of pieces of ivory. So it really was this luxury item, but one that Am Yisrael was familiar with, right? We also hear about Shlomo getting elephants among the other luxury animals like monkeys and peacocks that he has imported from Africa. Okay, elephants are big and frightening animals, right? Think about if you've never seen an elephant before, not in real life, not on YouTube, never. It's scary. Okay. So the Greeks use elephants as tanks. They are their tanks. Okay. And we have in the Book of Maccabees this description, okay? They divided the beasts, the elephants, among the armies, and for every elephant, they appointed 1,000 men armed with coats of mail and helmets of brass on their head. For every beast were ordained 500 horsemen of the best, Wherefore, all that heard the noise of their multitude and the marching of the company and the rattling of the harness were moved, for the army was very great and mighty, right? It's a very, very frightening thing to imagine, right? You have all of these soldiers and armor, but also the elephants. We know there's a very famous story about one of the Maccabees, Elazar Maccabee, who sacrifices himself. He goes on a suicide mission to kill the chief elephant, hoping that the general is sitting on it. Doesn't actually work, but that's what he does. Now, the rabbis know about elephants. Okay. First of all, elephants were seen at some point in the land of Israel, even if only in pictures. We have mosaics and mural drawings of elephants. Okay. You have one here on the top. This is from a burial cave in Beit Guvrin from the second century before the Common Era. And on the bottom, this is from a mosaic from Caesarea in the Roman period. Right? So we have these images of elephants, and Chazal know about them. Right? And they write about them sometimes in very strange circumstances. So, for example, one of the best ones here is a sukkah. You can make a sukkah where one of the walls is an elephant, okay? And it's not very practical, but certainly is amusing. In the case where one established a wall with a tied elephant, everyone agrees that the sukkah is fit, as even if the elephant dies and falls, its carcass still has a height of 10 hand breadths, right? I don't know if you really want to be sitting in your sukkah where one wall is a dead elephant, but you can, if you were wondering, you can. Okay. We also have in Masechet Brachot, right? We have all the blessings that we make on all sorts of interesting phenomena. Among them are rainbow, thunder, lightning, but also strange creatures, right? The sages taught if you see an elephant, a monkey, or a vulture, you say, blessed is Hashem who makes creatures different. Mishaneh habriot. Okay. Elephants, the rabbis knew about elephants. They talk about their very long gestational period. They talk about how they're intelligent. They understand that they're intelligent. The Masechet Gittin talks about giving an elephant a get to take from one person to another. But probably the most famous or infamous Chazal about an elephant is in Masechet Kiddushin, right? Where we have a description of, not a description, a conversation about how you can acquire something, okay? And you can acquire something by lifting it, by pulling it, right? But then how do you acquire an elephant, right? It's very, very heavy. You can't lift it up. So you have, the Gemara talks about how you can either put the elephant inside, standing inside dishes, and then the dishes belong to you, so the elephant belongs to you too, right? Or you can pull it. But one opinion says you hold up vines. And Tosfot says, well, how does that help you? What does that do for you? And it says that Rabbi Meshulam, if you look here, Mefaresh HaRab Meshulam, Delahachi Nakat Chavilez Morot, these vines, Lefishehen Ma'achal Pio, this is a food that an elephant eats, as we know in Shabbat. It tells us what foods different animals eat. Metaltelim Chavilez Morot B'Shabbat, Mipneshehen Ma'achal Lepilin. Okay, so it's elephant food. Very nice. Magbihin lapio chavilez morot lemala. You lift up these vines high up. Behu kofetz umagbia et atzmo min haaretz ve'ochlam. The elephant wants to get the vines, so he jumps and he grabs at the vine. And by lifting himself up, you have then acquired him. This is very clever of Rabbi Meshulam. It's a very interesting explanation to the Gemara. The only problem is elephants can't jump. Okay? Elephants can't jump. It's physically impossible for them. They are very, very heavy. Their legs are meant to carry their very heavy weight. They are unable to jump. And they also have, if you look at the structure of the bones of an elephant, okay, I want you to picture Barbie feet, right? You know how Barbie has those pointy high-heeled feet? That's what elephants have. Their bones go, the foot bone goes straight down. They are incapable of jumping. So there are people who say, well, look, how could Chazal get something wrong? Clearly, Chazal speak nonsense. No. Okay. And this is again, Natan Slifkin. We mentioned him a few times last week and we'll mention him again now. He says, you know what? Most people in medieval France, just like in Eretz Yisrael in the time of the rabbis, hadn't seen an elephant, and they certainly had no knowledge of whether an what an elephant was physically capable of. Even if they had seen pictures of it, They didn't know if an elephant could jump or couldn't jump. When would you have ever seen it? Even people who go to the zoo don't know if elephants can jump or can't jump. So the fact that Rabbi Meshulam gives this answer doesn't mean he's a fool. It means he's never seen an elephant. And it's a perfectly natural and normal mistake to make. So that's just the famous elephants. Can elephants jump, right? White men can't jump, neither can elephants. Okay, just to finish up our animal stories, the Gemara has in various places crazy animal stories, right? Fantastic beasts, right? Huge creatures that, or mythical creatures, right? A lot of them are from a rabbi named Rabbi Bar Bar Chana. Rabbi Bar Chana was a traveler, and he would tell these, what we would call in modern times, fish stories, right? That he was traveling and he saw these huge beasts. I brought you two examples here, right? One is in a whole kind of a series of these stories in Bava Batra. Hey, Rabbi Bar Bar Chana said, I have seen a certain frog, an akrota, that was as large as the fort of Hagronia. And how large is the fort of Hagronia? As large as 60 houses. A snake came and swallowed the frog, right? So it has to be bigger than the frog. A raven came and swallowed the snake and flew up and sat in a tree. See how great is the strength of the tree. Rav Papa Bar Shmuel said, if I had not been there and seen this, I would not believe it, right? It's very, very unbelievable, right? A frog that's as big as a town, that's eaten by a bird that's bigger than it, that's eaten by a snake that's bigger than it, that's put in a tree, right? Crazy, right? And we have another one. Rabbi Bar Bar Chana said, we were traveling in a ship and we saw a certain fish in whose nostril a mud eater had sat and killed him. And the waters thrust the fish and threw it upon the shore, and 60 districts were destroyed by the fish, right? You get the idea here. Okay? They were cutting beams from the bones of the fish and went to build the houses. Okay? We have this is about animals that are real but just enormous. We also have animals that are kind of mythical. Rabbi Bar Bar Chana says, I have seen a day-old offspring of the Re'em. Right? We have a Re'em in the Torah, Karnei Re'em Karnav, unclear what it is. He says it was as large as Mount Tabor. And the length of the cub's neck was 3 parasangs, and the place where its head rests was a parasang and a half. And when it cast feces, it dammed up the Jordan. Right? What do we do with these crazy stories? Right? These are very strange stories. So there are different approaches to what to do with these stories. Right? One approach is sometimes we have mistakes in translation, in the text. Right? It's possible. Here, not with these particular stories, but you do have sometimes where the translations or the emendations of the text are incorrect. And once you fix that, fix the language, it makes more sense. Sometimes you have situations where nature can change. We don't like to resort to that too often because it doesn't really happen. But in the case of stories like this, okay, the Vilna Gaon looks at this story and he says, clearly, clearly, this is not a story about a real creature, the frog. This is a metaphor. This is meant, what Chazal are doing are they are trying to teach you something. Chazal are always using different methods to teach you something, right? A very famous one is gematria. Okay, don't take the number thing so seriously. It's a way to teach you things. Same thing here. So the frog is a scholar, a Talmid Chacham. He is as big as 60 houses. He's able to study the 60 tractates of the Mishnah. Okay, the challenges that he has. Right, all you could come up with all different kinds of answers. Besides that, think about it. Chazal are living, give or take, 1500 years ago. Think about the belief in mythological creatures in ancient Greece, in ancient Rome, in medieval Europe. Up until, look, there are people today who believe in the Loch Ness Monster and in the Abominable Snowman and all these. So it's not that crazy that Chazal could also have stories like this. I personally like the metaphorical idea, and take it as you like. Okay? But an example of one kind of creature that is mentioned in the Torah and we try to figure it out is a creature called the Tachash. Okay? If you, in about, a month and a half, we're going to get to the descriptions of the Mishkan. Okay, just looking if the sources are here. No. Okay. Yes, I don't know about the elephants, but we'll come back to it. Okay. In the Mishkan, we have skins that are on the roof of the Mishkan, and they are described. Orot elim ma'adamim, va'orot tichashim va'atzei shitim. Okay, we're not going to go into the elim and the shitim, but we have something that's skins of a tachash. What is a tachash? Okay, so Uncleus translates the tachash as a sasgona. And Rashi says, sasgona, he's sas, he's excited about his gvanim, about his colors. He's proud of his colors. Now, Uncleus is building on what the Gemara says. Okay, the Gemara in Shabbos discusses this tachash. Okay, we have a variation in the Yerushalmi, but basically, look at what it says here. Rabbi Elah said that Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish said that Rabbi Meir used to say, the tachash that existed in the days of Moses was a creature unto itself, meaning it's a creature that never existed after that. It was a singular thing. And the sages did not determine whether it was a type of undomesticated animal or a type of domesticated animal, right? Is it a chaya or a behemah? Here's where it gets interesting for us. And it had a single horn on its forehead. And this tachash happened to come to Moses for the moment. So it exists only in that time period. It has a horn on its forehead. What does this remind us of? A unicorn. Okay.
Unicorn.
And then we go into the Midrash Tanchuma. Okay. And we get an even better detail, right? Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemiah discussed this verse. Rabbi Yehuda said it was a large, pure animal with a single horn on its forehead and a skin of six different colors that roamed the desert. So the Midrash Tanchuma is even better. It's not only a unicorn, it's a rainbow unicorn, right? You thought rainbow unicorns are things that like 6-year-old girls got into like a year ago? No, rainbow unicorns are in the Midrash Tanchuma. Now, what's the deal, right? Is it really a unicorn? What does that mean? We know that unicorn is a mythological animal that people were fascinated by in ancient times. Okay, this is a picture of one of the gates of the Persian city of Shushan. Okay, and this is perhaps a drawing of a unicorn, right? We also have unicorns in medieval Europe, where we have the famous unicorn tapestries. People are fascinated by this idea of this one-horned creature. Chazal are fascinated too. Now, what is the unicorn and what perhaps is the tachash? We have a lot of different suggestions. One suggestion for a unicorn, even though it seems very strange, there are creatures that have a horn. Okay, this is one of them. It's called the narwhal. Okay, this one up here. This is a sea creature. It has one long tusk. It doesn't really appear in our area. It's really in much colder waters, but sometimes a pod strays in a different directions, and maybe it could have ended up here. This is one suggestion for the tachash. Some people suggest a rhinoceros, which also has a one horn. Some people suggest a giraffe because a giraffe has a beautiful skin. It has two horns, but it also has a pointy thing in the middle of its forehead. Okay. Another suggestion, much less beautiful than the giraffe, is this creature over here. It's called a dugong. It's a sea creature that lives in the Red Sea. Okay. It has a strong skin. Its skin is used for shoes, and we have a pasuk in Yechezkel that talks about the tachash used for shoes. None of these are particularly perfect. One of the most accepted answers, it's much less sexy than the other answers, but it might be correct, is we have something called duchsu, which sounds a little like tachash, and it's very fancy beadwork, something that we have in the Arab world. Maybe this is not an animal at all. Maybe it's just talking about a style of work that you would do on the fabric itself. So the tachash is still mysterious. By the way, if you go to the Ari Shul in Tzfat, the Arvi Ashkenazi Shul, they have a stucco box that has a beautiful picture of a rainbow unicorn on it, and the medrash about the tachash. And some people are very into this idea. They really, really like this idea that it's a rainbow unicorn, which is very cool, but kind of hard to prove in nature. Okay, we are done with animals and we are going to move back to plants that we started talking about. Okay, so one of the things that we hear a lot about in the Torah as well as in the Mishnah and the Gemara is ketoret and perfume. Okay, In the Torah, we hear about the Ketoret. The Ketoret in the Beit HaMikdash, right, in the Mishkan and in the Beit HaMikdash, you have in the Kodesh, inside the Mikdash itself, you have the Kodesh and the Kodesh Kodashim. Kodesh Kodashim is the Aron, right, the Aron HaBrit. But in the Kodesh, you have the Menorah, you have the Shulchan, and you have the small gold altar, the Mizbeach HaKetoret. And you put a mixture of incense of Ktoret on it. Now, we have two different sources here. Now, we have the source in the Torah. I deliberately brought it for you in Hebrew without an English translation because it's disputed what these words mean, okay? But yeah, not the beginning, right? Vayomer Hashem Moshe kach lechasamim, take these different kinds of spices, nataf ushachelet vechelbonah, Samim ulivona zakah bad bebad yiyah. So we have basically four ingredients, okay? Nataf, shachelet, chelbona, and livona. Now, the Gemara, and a lot of people say this passage every day, okay? The Gemara includes expands on this idea, okay? Tana Rabbanan, pitum haktoret. This is how you make the ktoret. Hatsori, hatsiporen, hachelbona, vahalivona. Okay, so it takes these four things, and that taf, they explain, is a tsori. Don't worry if this doesn't help you very much. We're going to try to explain it a little more. The shachelet is tsiporen. The chalbona is chalbona, okay? And the livona is livona. Okay, so what are these different things? And then they add in other ingredients. Mor, ktsia, shibboleth nerd, karkom, okay? Kinamon, right? Different things. So we have, this is a very nice thing on the internet, right? The different ingredients, some of which we know, some of which we're not sure about. Tsori, we're going to talk about. This is what we call in Hebrew today a farsimon, not a persimmon, but balsam. Okay, so tsori b'Gilead, right? Do we have they have balm in Gilead? That's this spice. Tziporen is cloves. Livona is frankincense. We're going to talk about that. Mor is myrrh. Okay, and then we have all these other ones. Cinnamon, we know cinnamon. Others, not so clear. Is karkom saffron, maybe, right? We're not so sure about all of these. We know that we have all these various different plants, okay? Three main ones, the tsori, the livona, and the mor, all come from the same family. Okay, these are trees that create perfume. We're going to see a little more about the livona and the myrrh. And there was a specific group of Kohanim whose job it was to make the Ketoret, and they're called the House of Avtinos. And we hear about them in the Mishnah. We hear about them in the Gemara in Yuma. And they did not want to teach the secret of the preparation of the incense. Now, you say, what secret? We just heard all the ingredients. Where's their secret, right? Clearly, anybody can make
The
this recipe. No,
amounts.
right? It's not about the ingredients, and it's not even about the amounts. It's about the
Oh.
technique of creating the smoke that it goes should go straight up in the air. Okay, so we have this story about the Beit Avtinos. The sages taught in a braita, the members of the house of Avtinos were expert in the technique of preparing the incense, and they did not want to teach others. Now, they have a monopoly. Of course, they don't want to teach others. They're going to make a nice amount of money. Okay? The rabbis were not happy about this. The sages sent for and brought craftsmen from Alexandria and Egypt. We're going to get it from China. We're not paying you this monopoly price. The Alexandrian craftsmen knew how to blend the spices, but they did not know how to cause the smoke to rise like the House of Avtinos. So I didn't bring you the whole Gemara, but basically the rabbis have to come back to the Beit Avtinos and they have to pay them twice as much, right? It's not particularly nice. But they're the only ones who know the secret of how to make the smoke grow up. But they do say a nice thing about Beit Avtinos, right? First of all, they say, why don't they want to teach anybody? It's not only about the money. They say, one day we know the Beit HaMikdash is going to be destroyed and we don't want idol worshippers to use to make this Ketoret in their temples. But also, they never would let the women in their household use perfume. because they didn't want anyone to think that they were using the incense for their own perfume. Now, perfume, we think, Chanel number five, going to the duty free. We have perfume. No, perfume exists in the ancient world. And it's actually really important in the ancient world because the ancient world smells really bad. Okay. Just a lot of smells. There's a lot. You're out there in nature. We haven't, made everything all artificial. And a woman who was wealthy enough would go out with a little, it's called a tzlochit shel pleton, a little perfume vial. And this is one of the things that the Mishnah and Shabbos talks about, what you're allowed to carry on Shabbat if you don't have an Eruv. So you're not allowed to go out with this perfume vial, but a woman would wear such a thing as a necklace, right? Think about smelling salts in Victorian times, right? And you get to, I don't know, the Refet, right? The cow shed, and you're like, ugh, this is disgusting. And you'd smell your perfume. Now, we found one of these in the excavations in Migdal, in a Beit She'ani town near the Kinneret. Now, what did the perfume smell like? That's a really good question. So we're going to take a look at a few different perfuming ingredients. Okay, so first we have Livona, Mor and Livona. In Shir HaShirim, we have nerd vikarkon kaneh vekinamon im kol atzei levona mor va'olot im kol roshei besamim. All of the beautiful perfumes, right? Nard and saffron, fragrant reed and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, right? That's important. The levona and the mor come from trees. Myrrh and aloes, all the choice perfumes. Okay, the levona is its scientific name is Boswellia thuriferia, but in English it's called frankincense, okay, which is a strange name, right? Why frankincense? Frankincense means, in Old French, the pure or noble incense. Crusaders came to the land of Israel and they discovered this. Now, if you go, rediscovered it. If you go into the Shuk in the Old City, okay, in the spice stores, you'll see this, frankincense and myrrh. It's a big deal for Christians because when baby Jesus is born, according to the New Testament, the three wise men bring him gifts of frankincense and myrrh. So to be able to come and to see this, wow, this is really exciting. However, it's also exciting for us because not only do we use these spices, which are actually like a resin from the tree, and they don't smell like anything until you burn them, like you have to heat them up. Not only do we use them for the ketoret, we use them for the menachot. Okay, when we give meal offerings, when we make these pancakes that you give as an addendum to your korbanot, they have to have oil and they have to have livona. So livona is a really big deal as part of the menachot. This guy on the bottom, by the way, this is in Africa somewhere. He's collecting the resin off of the myrrh trees. Okay. Now, these plants are actually fascinating because not only do they have a nice smell, I don't particularly like it, but it is a strong smell, okay? And not only do they are they important for ritual things, but they actually have healing properties. And the rabbis already knew this. Okay? Gemara and Sanhedrin, if you're doing the daf, this is going to be coming up next week. When a person is led to be executed, we want to be merciful. We want to kind of dull his senses and sort of put him a little bit in a calm frame of mind. So Rav Chisda said the court gives one who is being led out to be killed a grain of frankincense and a cup of wine in order to confuse his mind. It's a tranquilizer. Today, studies that are being done on the Livona find that it can be an antidepressant. It can be used against certain kinds of cancer. It's actually a really strong, it's a strong drug. We're learning all these different things. Because Mor and Livona are so important in the Beit HaMikdash, we have a beautiful midrash, in Shir HaShirim, Elechli al Har Hamor el Givat HaLivona. So it says Har Hamor, the mountains of myrrh, refers to the Beit HaMikdash, to the temple, Shayu Makrivim Bo Mor, that they would bring offerings of myrrh, and Givat HaLivona Zo Yerushalayim. This is Jerusalem, where they would bring the offerings of Livona. Okay, so Mor and Livona, by the way, this, as well as the next one we're going to talk about, the Afar Simon, people today are researching and trying to grow these things again and trying to figure out these ancient scents, growing them in Eretz Yisrael, meaning we do grow them in other places, but we want to grow them here. Okay, probably the most famous of the perfumes is the afarsimon, what's called in the Torah, the nataf, what's called in the Mishnah, the tzori. Okay, but it's also called afarsimon. And afarsimon is confusing because if you live in Israel, you have those orange, fat little orange fruits that are called persimmons. Okay, they are called afarsimon, but that's not the afarsimon we're talking about. There's absolutely no connection between them. Okay, afarsimon is a balsam plant. Okay, you're seeing here kind of a nice botanical drawing of it. It's called Commiphora gileadiensis, as in balm of Gilead, which is what we hear about in Sefer Yirmiyahu. It is used as a perfume. It's also used as an oil. Okay, the Gemara says, Rabbi Chisdor says to Rabbi Yitzchak, what blessing is said over shemen afarsimon, the oil of the balsam? He said, Rabbi Yehuda says, Borei Shemen Artzeinu, who creates the oil of our land. So then Rav Chisda said, well, forget about Rabbi Yehuda, who dotes on the land of Israel, right? He's a real, jingoist for Eretz Israel. What do ordinary people say? Says Rabbi Yochanan says, who creates pleasant oil, right? Shemen Arev. Now, balsam oil smells very nice. However, you are not supposed to use it to light your Shabbat menorah, your Shabbat candles. Why not? Because balsam oil is very, very volatile. And the Gemara tells a terrible story, right, which is this. A certain mother-in-law hated her daughter-in-law. She said to her, go and adorn yourself with balsam oil. She went and adorned herself. On her return, she said to her, go and light the lamp. She went and lit the lamp. A spark flew out at her and consumed her. Do not tell this story to your mother-in-law. It's a very bad story. Now, where do we grow the afarsimon? I realize I see I didn't put in the source for this. I'm sorry. Maybe it's also in Shabbat. I'd have to find it. So we hear about when the Bnei Israel are taken, Bnei Yehuda, right? The Shevet Yehuda is taken into exile by the Babylonians. They only leave behind the Kormim and the Yogvim. So the Gemara says, what are the Kormim and the Yogvim? The Kormim are the balsam gatherers from En Gedi to Ramah. And the Yogvim are the guys who catch the chilazon, who make the tchelet. So these are two very, very valuable industries. We want those people to keep on doing this. But what this tells us is that the balsam grows in the area of Midbar Yehuda. And if you look on this picture over here, this is part of the Medva map. We looked at this in our last series that we did, right? Famous mosaic on a church in a church in Jordan from the 6th century of the Common Era. It's got all kinds of great details. This is showing you the Jordan with the fish leading into the Dead Sea. No fish. Okay, but what's emphasized over here is on the eastern side of the Jordan, you have a nice little plant. This is a balsam plant. This is an afarsimon plant, because that's what grows here. Now, the people of En Gedi were able to build themselves a beautiful shul with mosaics, and one of the mosaics has writing, it has an inscription. Sometimes mosaics will have, often shul mosaics will have, Zichurim Latov, we remember the people who gave the money, blah, blah, blah. Sometimes they'll have a bracha for the people who have donated to the shul. Sometimes they'll have a klala, they'll have a curse, and that's what this is. Okay? Anyone who causes strife among his fellow men or informs on them to non-Jews or steals his friend's possessions, or here's the part that's important to us, tells the secret of the city to non-Jews. He whose eyes roam the whole land and see everything hidden will smite that man and his children and destroy him from the earth, and everyone say Amen. Okay? Pretty nice curse. What's the secret of the town? We think the secret of the town is the technique of making the perfume, right? Of knowing how to grow the balsam, of how to make it into perfume. Today, We are able to grow the balsam. We still don't know how to make the perfume, right? We don't have anybody from Engedi who has taught this to us. There's an amazing scholar named Zohar Amar. I talked about him in the last series, who's doing all kinds of things trying to figure out what did the Lechem HaPanim look like, and what are the stones of the Choshen, and he's working on this Afar Simon and what was it like. So that's just a cool thing to know about. Okay, moving along, another plant that's a really great plant is the tsalaf, or the caper bush. I happen to love the caper bush. I have in my backyard a caper bush, and caper bushes are great because they die every year, but they always grow back. You can cut it back. We're going to see it's very hard to kill. Okay. It dies and then it just comes back the very next spring. Now, capers are very interesting because they have a lot of different parts that are edible. We today, only if you're a fancy person, you might put in your salads caper buds, right, that are pickled. But other than that, we don't eat the rest of it. But capers have a lot of parts. They have flowers, they have leaves, and after you have the buds that open up into the flowers, and then they die, and then you have these these berries. Okay. Now, in the time of the Mishnah, in the time of the Gemara, people had less to eat, and they ate lots of things, right? And we see here in these first two sources that people ate everything. Rabbi Elazar says, as for the caper bush, tithes, right, maaser, must be given from the shoots, the timrot, the berries, the evyonot, and the blossoms, kipras, okay? Meaning, why do you have to give maaser? Because you eat them all. Rabbi Akiva says, no, only the berries are tithes, since they alone count as fruits, okay? But in Brachot, we say caper bushes that people plant with their fruit in mind. We learned in the Mishnah in regards to the parts of the caper bush over the leaves and the young fronds, you say creates the fruit of the ground, borei pri ha'adamah, and over the berries and buds, he recites who creates the fruit of the tree. People would eat all the different parts. Now, capers ripen, they're actually really cool because it takes them a good month, 6 weeks, till they have all ripened and flowered. It doesn't happen all at once. You know, you come outside, you say, oh, today there's two buds, tomorrow there's three buds, right? And obviously the rabbis notice all these things. Okay, so Rabban Gamliel sat and interpreted, the future trees will produce fruits every day. As it is stated, it shall bring forth branches and bear fruit. Just as a branch grows every day, so too fruit will be produced every day. A certain student scoffed at him and said, isn't it written there's nothing new under the sun? Right? It says, Ein chadash tachat ha-shemesh. God's not going to recreate the world. If we don't have it now, we're not going to have it in the time of Mashiach. Rabban Gamliel said, come and I will show you an example of this in this world. And he went outside and showed him a caper bush. So something that every day you have something new. Now we're going to see another quality of the caper, but we have this great midrash here in Gemara and Shabbos that talks about a man who there was a hole made in his field, a breach in his fence, and he decided to fence it in. And then he remembered it was Shabbat. And that pious man refrained from fixing the fence forever because he had thought about fixing it on Shabbat. And a miracle was done for him, and a caper bush grew there, and from it he received his livelihood and the livelihood of the members of his household. Now, one of the things I didn't tell you about the caper bush that's not so nice about it, it's very thorny. Okay? It's got a lot of little annoying prickly thorns. So it's actually very useful as a fence, but it's also something that you can eat. So this is the Gemara. The Kabbalists, okay, the Chida, takes this Gemara and does something very nice with it. He says, remember that in the Midbar you have Slofchad and his daughters, right? Remember Benot Slofchad. Benot Slofchad come to Moshe and they say, our father wasn't with the Meraglim and he wasn't with Korach. But he died from his sin, bechet omet, his own sin. And the rabbis say, what was his sin? Nobody, the rabbis never like to have anybody anonymous. So we have a guy who's the mikosheshet tzim. He cuts wood on Shabbat and he's killed. And the rabbis say, oh, that's slavchad. Okay, that's the, we have the pasuk, we have the midrash, and then we have another level. The chida comes along and he says, the mikosheshet tzim is slavchad. Slavchad is somebody who didn't keep Shabbat. He's reincarnated as this man in Shabbat, who then is so careful about Shabbat that what does he get as a reward? A tzalaf echad. Tzalaf is a caper bush. He gets one caper bush. Tzalaf echad, tzlofchad. Right? It's beautiful. Okay. Now, somebody's got to take all those little buds and pickle them, right? And make them into capers. And that was a job in the old days. And we actually know about people, there's more than one person. We know about people who are called hakapar, okay? Just like we say caper in English, it's not an English word. It's a word that comes from Greek, I believe. And it's used by the rabbis. And we have people who are called hakapar. They make things out of the capers. And one of the very few rabbis that we get to see, like a real inscription of his name, okay, in the Golan, we have a lintel, on top of the door that was found that says, Zehu Beit Midrasho Shel Rabbi Elazar Hakapar. We know Rabbi Elazar Hakapar. We see him in the Mishnah and the Gemara. And this is his Beit Midrash, but it's just nice to see that. Now, the other thing that we know about the caper is it is very, very persistent. If you go to the Kotel, anyone who's been to the Kotel or seen pictures of the Kotel, which I assume is everybody here, has seen the bushes that grow out of the Kotel. And you say, what the heck? How are there bushes growing out of this wall? These are caper bushes. Capers, you can't kill them, even if they weren't so nice, right? And you wanted to kill them. You can't kill them. They don't die. They're a weed. They grow on the sides of roads. You see them everywhere. Okay. And again, the rabbis, lessons from the world. They love lessons from the world. So Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish said, there are three impudent ones. Now, that's not a great translation. The word in Hebrew is az, shlosha azim. Az, you can translate, right? Last week we said az kinamer, right? Az is someone who could be brazen. We might say chutzpahdik, somebody who doesn't give up, somebody who is just keeps on going. Now, the main one is us, right? The Jewish people among the nations and the dog, the rooster, the goat, and some say the caper bush among the trees, right? The tzalaf, the caper is us. He is brazen. It just won't go away. Like us, we just won't go away. As much as people want to get rid of us, too bad. We won't go away. Okay. Really nice plant called the chatzav. If you live in Israel, you know what the chatzav is. Certainly, if you sent children or grandchildren to Gan here, right? Every child who goes to kindergarten here comes home in the fall and says, "Hachatzav poreach, hakayitz boreach." When the chatzav flowers, this is the chatzav here in the middle, that means the summer is over. The summer is running away. Okay, these are plants that flower in the fall, the very end of the summer. They start to come up around Tu B'Av at the end of the summertime, in the beginning of the fall. Sorry, not the end of the fall, the beginning of the fall. And you see them all over the place. They're called Dreamia or Sea Squill. It doesn't really matter what they're called in English because you would not have seen them. I don't think, maybe they grow in California. I don't know. But in Israel, they grow all over the place. Now, they're very interesting plants. And again, lessons from plants. Rami Bar Abba said, the chatzav will cut off the feet of the wicked. Mekateh ragleim derishiya. What does that mean? Okay. Rashi says, Esef sheshorashav nokvim v'yordim ba'omek. This is a plant, a grass, really, whose roots go deep down into the ground. Ve'ein mitpashet l'tzadim. It doesn't spread out, right? Don't think of a root that goes out widthwise. It just goes straight down. Ve'ein mitpashet l'tzadim klal. Vinotinotobeg vulesadot. You plant it as a border marker because it goes straight down. Ubotichem Yoshua Israel Taaretz, right? And we're going to see this in the Gemara in Bava Batra. This is the plant that Yoshua used to make the boundaries of the tribes of Eretz Israel. What does it mean? Mekatea regle rishaim, cutting off the feet of the wicked. Liyom hadin shegozlin v'chomsim u'misigin gvul v'ein lemedim imenu. Bad people, villains who steal and move the boundary markers to steal somebody else's land, Hashem is going to say, why didn't you look at my chatzav and learn from the chatzav how they behave, that they are so straight, right? Straight, tarte mashma, straight. They grow straight down and they're straight. They're honest. They never steal from anyone. Okay. So this is known as a plant that is good for border, for boundary markers, because it grows straight down, because it grows deep, and because it's mostly poisonous, okay? And I'll say mostly because we'll see there's an animal that does eat it. The bulbs have a lot of poison in them, so animals won't eat them. So it's going to stay. And so it's used as a border marker even today. The Arabs call it the plant of the dead. They use it to mark off cemeteries. And actually, if you go in Gay Ben Hinnom today, there are a lot of like old abandoned cemeteries, and you can see chatzavim that were planted there to mark the boundary. Now there are animals that eat them. Who eats them? Right. So first we have this Gemara in Bava Batra, the chatzav. Rabbi Yehuda says the growth by which Yeshua established the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. That's what Rashi brought us before. Okay. The Gemara in Shabbos gives us different food for different animals. You may move chatzav on Shabbat because it is food for gazelles. The gazelles are able, and you have this, also the Medrash, Rabbi Levi said, what did Noach take into the ark? He took branches for the elephants, right? Remember the elephants like the vines? Chatzuvot for the gazelles and glass for the ostriches. I'm not sure about that one. Okay, but gazelles, and this is actually true, we know there have been studies done it, gazelles will eat the chatzav. When will they eat it? They'll eat it either when it's very, very young and tender and doesn't have a lot of poison, or they'll eat it at the very end of the season when it's kind of weak and dying, and they are able to metabolize it. They're able to eat it. So we do have animals who eat it, but not so many. Just give you a nice little thing that I read, somebody named Shai Levi. He says the chatzav is a very nice example for us, for Am Yisrael. Says it it's a different kind of plant. It goes its own way. Okay. At the end of the summer, all the flowers have finished flowering. All the green is gone. There's no more water until the new, rains are going to come. But the chatzav says, now is my time. I'm going to dig deep. I'm going to find water and I'm going to flower and I'm going to stand out in the landscape because nothing else is flowering. So he says, Am Yisrael, we should have deep roots. We should have independence and think in our own way. And we should have the simplicity and the beauty of the chatzav. Oh, it's a nice lesson. Okay. Flax, pishtan, right? We know you're not supposed to mix semer and pishtan, right? The wool and linen is shatnez. Flax was a very important household industry. You use flax for lots of different things. And that's this nice picture down here from Wikipedia. Okay. You can use the flax seeds to make oil. It's called linseed oil. And you use the flax stalks. You have to soak them and dry them, and then you get fibers from them that you can use for anything from like really thick ropes to the finest linen. And linen is something that was very, very valuable. Okay. In Eshet Chayil, right? Darsha tzemer upishtim. Here's this thrifty housewife, and what does she do? She is making the flax so that she can have something for her household. However, there's a catch. Okay? In order to make this linen, you need to do something called redding. You need to take your flax and you need to soak it, preferably in stagnant water, for a few months. And it's smelly and it's disgusting. Okay. The Gemara in Nedarim talks about what vows a husband can annul. His wife makes a vow, and he says, "Oh, no, honey, I'm not living with that vow." Okay, and he can annul it for her. So if she says, "I'm not going to bathe if I don't bathe in mei mishra, water in which flax was soaked. I'm going to soak in this disgusting water, otherwise I'm never going to take a bath." He can say, "Sorry, sweetheart, I'm annulling that vow. Okay, I can't live with somebody who's going to be that disgusting." Okay, now interestingly enough, we know that flax was made in Eretz Yisrael, right? Reish Lakish talks about flax being made in Beit She'an. It was a good industry. Now there's a town in the Golan. It's called Umm el-Qanitir. That's the Arab name of it. We don't know what it was called in the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara. They have a gorgeous, gorgeous shul. This is the. It's not really a reconstruction. It's taking the real stones and putting them back into place. It has this beautiful aron over here. How did this little town in the Golan have the money to build such a beautiful shul? So we found these very interesting looking pools. And at first, the archaeologist said, "Well, maybe this is something that's used for some kind of religious ritual, right? Some kind of water pan, water sprite, who knows?" But now we think that these were actually this was the secret of this town. They didn't make the Afar Simon, they made linen. This is their soaking pools to soak the linen and to make it into very valuable linen, right? To soak the flax and to make it into linen. Okay, one more thing about flax. We have the story in Yehoshua of Rahav, right? Remember Rahav, who saves the spies who come into Jericho and they're being chased after, right? And she goes and she hides them on the roof under some stalks of flax. Okay, Ze'ev Erlich, the person who we dedicated the whole last series of classes to, he says, Rahav, we hear a lot about Pishtan in the story of Rahav. Maybe not Pishtan itself, but the products of Pishtan. First of all, she has these flax stalks that are drying on her roof. Second, she helps the spies to escape by lowering them from a rope. She happens to have ropes lying around in her house. Third, they say to her, "Listen, when we come back, put this red string in your window." She's got threads that she puts into her window. So he creates a whole interesting industry. Maybe Rahav has that she's a flax industrialists. That's not the word I want, but you know what I mean. Okay. The last few things we're going to do are not necessarily plants, but a few other things. We'll see how many of them we get to. Okay. One of them is medicine. Medicine in the Gemara is vast. We are really only touching on it like mamash, not even the tip of the tip of the iceberg. But I just wanted to bring in a little bit. First of all, the person who wrote what is still considered to be the best book about medicine in the Gemara is it's a 19th century book. It's a guy named Dr. Julius Preuss. He was a Jewish doctor, really a doctor, like a medical doctor from Germany. And he wrote a book called Biblical and Talmudic Medicine. And he said himself that he is the only person he knows who is knows enough about medicine and enough about Gemara and Aramaic to be able to write this book. There may have been more modern studies, but as a comprehensive book, as far as I know, this is still the best one. It was only very recently translated from German into Hebrew. I brought you two things here. One is we have tons and tons and tons of medical advice in the Gemara. Some of it is advice that is still good today, right? Shmuel, who was a doctor, says, wash your hands all the time, right? We follow that advice today, right? Some of it is advice that we completely don't follow anymore, like bloodletting, right? And some of it is kind of this strange folk medicine that maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work. Who knows? And one of the people who brings a very interesting source for folk medicine is the Amora Abaye. Now, Abaye had kind of a sad life story. His mother died when he was an infant, and he had a foster mother, but he loved this foster mother. She was like a mother to him, right? And he always calls her Aim. Amra li Aim. That's his like catchphrase. My mother told me. And we have tons of different examples. I just brought you two here, right? And she gives him all sorts of advice. Not all of it is medical, by by the way. She also tells him other kinds of advice, like just what are smart ways to go about in the world. My mother told me a child's growth requires hot water and oil for smearing. When he grows a little, he must eat egg with kutach. Kutach is this disgusting fermented bread, right? That's the Gemara in Yoma. Abaye said, my mother told me these roasted grains are good for the heart and drive away worrisome thoughts. My mother told me if you suffer from weakness of the heart, you should bring the meat of the right thigh of a ram and the dung of grazing cattle and bring willow twigs and roast the meat on a fire made with the dung or twigs and eat it and drink some diluted wine. Okay, and you read this and you're like, really, what's going on here? Okay, so another thing to understand is that the doctor of ancient times, and not only ancient times, the Rambam talks about him also, is a doctor named Galen. And he lives in the second century of the Common Era. He's a doctor to gladiators. Eventually, he moves to Rome. He becomes a doctor to the Caesars. He's doctor to the stars. And his philosophy, which spreads to everybody, is that there are these. Everything in you is controlled by four different. He calls them humors, right? Four different kinds of liquids. Black bile, yellow bile, blood, and phlegm, and each one is parallel to one of the four elements, right? Earth, water, air, and fire. And each one is also connected to a either hot or cold or wet or dry. And your job is to keep your humors balanced. And a lot of what we're talking about in the Gemara is about that. Well, if you eat too much of this food, you have to eat something of that food because that's going to balance out your humors. Okay? And once you understand that, it sounds a lot less strange. Whether this is true or not, I will leave to the alternative medicine people. But this is definitely the cutting edge science that the Gemara is working with. Okay, we have other interesting things about medicine, among other things. Can you heal people on Shabbos? Can you take medicine on Shabbos? Right? Jesus gets in big trouble for healing people on Shabbos. Can you heal people at all? Right? You have the famous phrase, Tov HaRofeim LeGehinom, the best doctors are going to go to hell. Because healing, first of all, are you interfering with God's plan? Maybe God wants this person to be sick. But also, doctors, of course, run the risk of losing patients. So, medicine, fascinating topic. I really only brought in like just one little bit. Okay, we have three more things. We'll do one. We'll save the other two for next time. Caves. Okay, caves are a big deal in ancient times. Natural caves, man-made caves. Caves are very, very useful. They are climate controlled. Okay, they're cool in the summer, they're warm in the winter, they are safe. You can go underground, nobody knows where you are. In certain parts of the country, like near Beit Shemesh, Beit Guvrin, you have the ground, the rock is chalk, it's very soft, so it's easy to cut out building blocks, and then you have a basement. You use caves for storage, you use caves for industry, right? You might have an olive press in a cave. Cisterns, you use caves for burial, right? You have burial caves, and you use caves in times of trouble for hideouts. Okay, people took existing caves that might have been used for storage, and particularly in Bar Kokhba times, but other times as well. They dug these very narrow cave complexes, hideout caves, okay, that we hear about in our sources that people would use for guerrilla warfare, but they would also use just to save themselves. Okay, and we have a lot of kind of by the by, right? Mesiach Lefitumo references to these hideout caves. So, for example, we have this crazy thing in Yevamot. A mother and another woman had two sons, one each, and they gave birth to two other sons in hiding. And then it talks about the babies being mixed up. What? How could you mix up your babies? You're holding them. It's not a hospital because they're in a cave and it's dark. Okay. You had cities that would create a single machboah. It's this terrible Gemara here in Ketubot. You would have a hideout cave. Because as long as you have that hideout cave, you have the possibility that the women, when the soldiers are coming into the town and trying to rape everybody, that the women can go to that cave, even if they didn't go to the cave, but they could have gone to the cave, a woman can then return to her husband, the Kohen. We assume that she went to the cave and she wasn't raped, right? Very terrible halacha. But if a woman is raped and she's married to a Kohen, she cannot go back to marry him, to be with him. But if there's a cave, we say, oh, she went there. That's our escape route, right? In two different senses of the word. Okay, and finally, we have a very, very large cave, which is called Ma'arat Tzidkiyahu, Tzidkiyahu's Cave. It's a cave that you can visit today in Yerushalayim. It's right near Damascus Gate. It's a massive cave. The Gemara knows about it. Gemara says if you spend Shabbos in a cave, even if it's like the cave of Tzidkiyahu, right? It's this huge cave. You can walk through the whole of it and 2,000 cubits beyond, right? This is all about Tchum Shabbat and what's included in it. Even if this cave is so large that it goes past Tchum Shabbat, you can use it, right? So all different kinds of interesting things. Maybe we'll talk a little more about Tzidkiyahu's cave next time. But right now, let us take a look at all of our chat questions and comments. Okay. Yofi, hold on. Elephants can stand. There are circus elephants. I don't know, but they can't stand on their tippy toes. It's not the same as standing on your hind feet. But yes, I understand your point. You could stand on your hind feet to reach the vines. But okay. JPS translation has tachash as a seal. Yeah, everybody likes to give different kinds of things for tachash. We don't really know what it is. Wendell Jones and his incense discovery. I don't know anything about. I know Wendell Jones, right? He's the Indiana Jones guy, but I don't know anything about incense. So if you want to add that at the end, please do. Carl, more and Levonar in Erev Shel Shoshanim, of course, because it's taking it from Shir HaShirim. Yain Kafrisin is made from the caper bush. Oh, isn't that interesting? Like Kafrisim, like caper, as opposed to Kafrisim, like from the island of Kypros. Interesting.
It's also caper, pickled capers are described as astringent. And
Astringent, meaning
astringent, their taste
what is
is
the
stringent. And that
dries
accords with
things
what it
out.
says. No, that dries things out. It has a sharp, I don't know how to describe, astringent is the word. What does it say? What's the purpose of Yain Kafrisim? Shishorim bo et tziporin, kedei
Right.
shetihyeh aza,
Oh,
which
nice. So it makes it
makes
sharper.
sense. Yeah.
Interesting. Very nice. Okay, thank you. Do you have to pickle the caper buds? I think so. I've never tried it. All right, recipes. Redding. Yes, that's what it's called, redding. I don't think the German book has been translated to English. It's been translated to Hebrew. The doctor's name is there's Galen, but there's also Preuss, Preuss. Preuss. Yes, thank you, Susanna. Yocheved had to bury Moshe in a cave, right? Well, we have burial caves, right? Burial caves are very interesting. Carl Jacobs, would you like to share with us Wendell Jones and the incense?
Sure.
Carl Jacobs, did you? Oh, there you are. Okay,
Oh,
tell
yeah,
us.
I'm okay. There's a project that Oren Gutfeld is the senior archaeologist for. It's called the Qumran Project, and it's a group of people who worked with Wendell Jones when he was alive. They continue to work. They've been digging at Hyrcania, Twin Caves, a whole bunch of copper scroll type treasure hunting. And at some point, Wendell Jones and the team found a jugglet that had residue in it. The residue was sent off to be spectrographically analyzed, and apparently all the residue inside is representative of everything that would have been in Ketoret. And
Nice.
when he had it, the museum didn't want it. And then now the Israel Museum, I think, has possession of the jug,
Oh.
but I don't know whether it's seen in public or not.
What?
Nice. Thank you. Very interesting. Good you take the tour
Shirley,
guide course.
I'll send you I'll send you the link. Tour guide
Okay, good.
course. The ministry test is Monday.
Good luck. Carl is
Yeah,
going to be the
thanks.
next new tour guide. All right, everybody, you should have a Shabbat Shalom. We should have Bisorot Tovot, and we will meet next week when I think we're talking about death. I think that's our next one. Very
Next
cheerful.
on
Okay.
this, oh,
Shabbat
surely,
Shalom.
thank you,
Yeah.
surely.
Bisorot Tovot. Amen.
Julie, did you go to Maon this week?
Did I go to Maon, the Beit
This
Knesset Maon in Otef? Yes, it's being
it was
renovated. I
covered,
was very disappointed.
right. I tried to send you a message when I saw it advertise your trip. I tried to send you a message that it was the, you know, it was covered over because I was there with
Oh,
Huey
thank
a while
you.
ago. Yeah.
They told me it's going to be ready in 2 weeks, but the people we met at the Muay Thai Zarit Eshkol said that's ridiculous. It's not going to be ready in 2 weeks. So I don't
I
know.
mean,
Yeah, we
yeah,
drove up there and I was like, oh, this doesn't look so good. And then we saw
because
the workers and they uncovered a little bit for us, but it was disappointing.
Yui took us to Otef Azar about a month and a half ago, and he was also disappointed when we got there, and it was all covered up. Yeah.
Yeah, it was sad, but we did other things that were good. But thank you. I would have
Okay.
appreciated it, but it was fine. It was a 5 minute away from where we were going, so it was not like we lost a lot of time.
Biblical and
Thank
Talmudic
you.
medicine is available in English.
Really? That's so interesting, because when I was doing research into it not so long ago, they said, oh, it was just translated.
Published in 1978.
Very nice. Okay, thank you. Good that you're a good Googler.
Is
All
it out?
right.
I have the book.
You have it? You own it?
Hang on
Pat?
one second. I'll show it to you.
Show us, show us.
Is it out of
Is it
print,
interesting?
Julie?
Can you
Maybe
understand it?
he's coming back.
I don't know if it's, I mean, I don't know if it's still in print, but it's.
Oh, look at that. And what, Fred Rosner wrote the introduction?
No, it
Rabbi
says
Rosner?
translated by Fred Rosner.
Oh, he
Can we show
translated
that
it.
again,
That's
please?
What?
Show that again, please. Can we see that?
That's so cool. You know who he is, Fred Rosner, Rabbi Rosner. He just passed away recently. He's the big medical ethics guy.
Absolutely.
That's really cool. Thank you for sharing that with us. All right. Goodbye, everybody. I'm leaving.
Bye.
Goodbye, Ruchama.
Todah rabah.
Bye.